This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We need you to take this conversation beyond these walls after we conclude tonight and encourage other people to engage in this conversation in the way that we saw people are not engaging in open dialogue around this issue in the film. And so, Curtis, I want to begin with you as a provider who is operating in this kind of circumstance. You see the challenges that our lawmakers and our judiciary are giving us every day around this issue of safe medical procedures that at one point our Supreme Court told us was legal and acceptable and should be accessible. And now we're seeing that be chopped away at the knees almost on a daily basis. So what is it like for you to have to operate in that kind of environment?
When you speak to that piece of watching this film and that feeling of personal, you know, watching the film and having so many of those colleagues and friends be represented, and then actually looking out in the audience and seeing so many of my colleagues and the staff that I get to work with, it is so deeply personal. I mean, it is such deeply personal work, and that is what draws so many people to this work. Not everyone all of the time, but those people, I think it's Dalton in the film talks about, yes, this is something that you show up to 100%, and I think this is something you show up to like 500 and 1,000%. I mean, these are people who are so deeply committed to keeping the doors open and the impacts that that has on them, financial, emotional, mental health, all of those things. And, you know, it's sort of an amazing thing to watch and feel sort of deceptively okay in Pennsylvania, you know, and knowing how recently, as of earlier this week, there was the potential for a ban that was going to be passed restricting a literal medical procedure, the not just sort of a medical procedure that was medically safe, was proven the safest way to end a woman's pregnancy, and that was something that the legislator actually thought that they had the right to restrict. And so I think watching that and realizing, you know, here in Pennsylvania, the number of facilities that we actually have that provide such amazing care, the hospitals that provide such amazing care, and to also know that, you know, within the past couple of years, the Philadelphia Women's Center needed to spend upwards of $500,000 to put in a new HVAC system. So heating, vacuum, and air conditioning. I became an expert. And this was, we sort of called it like, you know, the golden egg. So this was this massive system that was put on the roof of our facility and has done absolutely nothing to improve the safety of procedures, because it is an incredibly safe procedure at all gestations of pregnancy. And when she talks about, you know, we haven't had an infection in 15 to 20 years, I mean, this procedure is incredibly safe. And so when providers are asked to do things like that, and you know that that $500,000, that $250,000, Dalton talks about this business that he's done, you want that money to go towards patients. You want that money to go to services. You want it to go to staff. There are so many good places for that money to go. You want it to go in places like Pennsylvania, Mississippi, Alabama, which do not have, you know, child health and mortality rates that we can be proud of. You know, that you want the money to go to those things. You want it to go to health promotion. And so the fact that so much of the energy gets spent towards those kinds of things is you know, a really harsh reality of some of this work. And I think one of the things that struck me again in watching that film was this very eerie quiet of those waiting rooms. And that is not what the waiting room in an abortion facility really is supposed to look like. It's a pretty busy place. It is full. There are a lot of women there with their families, their partners, spaces that are able to have children there, they have them. And so seeing those spaces be empty, you think, where are those women? Like, where are those people? Where are their families? It's not that they're not pregnant and they don't need an abortion. They're just not at places that they're able to get it. So what kind of providers are they with? What are they doing to themselves? And that, you know, I think that really struck me this time.
I want to, I might interject little things in the course of this dialogue, just for the sake of bringing everybody into a similar headspace that I'm in, because we talk about the legalities of this, and we talk about the human side of what this means regularly on the air on my station. For Philadelphia, just, you know, so that we don't get too self-righteous in the northeastern United States as opposed to the deep south that we saw in this film, Philadelphia is 67th out of 67 counties in the state of Pennsylvania for our health outcomes, as judged by surveys by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pennsylvania Department of Health. Part of the reason why we score so low consistently, and we've been 67th out of 67 for at least the last 3 years. I've been working at the station for four. Part of it is because of low birth weight. Babies, when we talk about babies that are carried to term, premature births is something else that involves this. So, you know, it's sort of easy to get caught up in the idea that for moral or religious purposes, we're saving babies, but the realities that babies are being born into are also extremely troubling in these states that are depicted, as well as right here in our backyard in Philadelphia. And so that brings me to you, Lexi, in asking more about what made you decide to become an activist and advocate in this work of preserving reproductive rights, and especially after being a student on this campus, you know, getting you involved.
Sure, thank you. So good evening, everyone. I want to thank you so much for being here and joining us in this really salient conversation, especially with everything that's going on in our current, right, socio-political climate. Hashtag ish got real. And we need to really be continuing these conversations in the spaces that we have access to. I want to speak a little bit to the framework that I approach my work with and my activism with, and that I approached much of my scholarship with while I was a student here as an undergrad at the University of Pennsylvania. And that is through the lens of reproductive justice. Reproductive justice is a framework of reproductive freedom for all people. It is a social change movement led by Black women and women of color at a particular moment in time when the fullness of their experiences as related to wellness and as related to reproductive health and reproductive rights were very much being marginalized and in some ways only spoken about in the context of abortion. And I don't want to take away from our discussion around abortion access this evening, but I do want to provide an analysis that calls us to broaden the way we look at reproductive justice issues as related to what it means for someone to be well and to access wellness resources, what it means for one to bear children, to not bear children, to birth their children in a way and in a through a process where they have social supports, and to raise and rear their children in a world that is free from violence and oppression. And so that is sort of the lens that I approach my work from, and in seeing sort of a lack of spaces that were doing advocacy work, you know, either through a reproductive rights only or reproductive health only spectrum, and then also, you know, to use the language of social justice, but even in those spaces to be almost criminalizing women of color specifically in the same ways that mirror mainstream media representations and narratives around these issues. You know, we saw the billboards of Black women, right? In 2010, we saw a resurgence of these billboards plastered across the United States depicting the most dangerous place for an unborn child to be a Black woman's womb. And so there's a lot of work that it takes just to deconstruct what that narrative is in addition to fighting these battles, these political battles as they arise. And I do believe that that work starts in the community and that that work starts with shifting culture and starts with conversations like the one we have here today.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. So in viewing the film, in kind of preparing for our conversation tonight, one of the things that struck me is how passionate these workers in this film feel about defending the rights to exist and to provide access for the women who are coming into these clinics. But I feel that in 2016, we are treating the word abortion, and I feel the need to kind of say it and sit up straighter when I say it, the way that I was told our family said cancer in the 50s. That people are afraid to say the word out loud and what kind of conversation or argument confrontation may engage just because we're having a conversation about abortions and access to abortions. And the other thing that struck me is that in 2016, we're having, since you mentioned hashtags, a moment where we have a hashtag called Do Your Job, because we have a vacancy in our Supreme Court. And so as much as we may have been compelled to sort of cheer the idea that the Center for Reproductive Rights has been allowed to push this case, this agenda, to the Supreme Court, there may not be a decision, a decisive decision, being able to be made in these state cases that get elevated while they're while there's an opportunity to have a split decision with only 8 justices. So I bring that back to you, Curtis, as you think about this as a provider, that we have an opportunity to elevate the conversation around reproductive rights, access to abortion, but what reality is there for us in any case that may be seen by the Supreme Court in this interim where we only have 8 justices, and if it's 4-4, what does that mean ultimately for any of the people who are seeking some kind of resolution?
Just so I clearly understand, seeking some type of resolution in terms of what we think the outcome will be?
Yes. If for this bill, this Texas bill that has placed these extreme restrictions on the way that abortions can be administered in the state of Texas, if the idea is that we want that the outcome should be to strike down that bill by having the case elevated to the Supreme Court and heard, and it could possibly come down 4-4, what does the rollback mean for the state of Texas?
So I think, unfortunately, you know, what happens in Texas doesn't stay in Texas. and, you know, we know that, and we know that, you know, in the film they reference the anti-legislators, you know, literally having a playbook of bills and legislation that have been created that gets passed around, and let's see what sticks. And there's a lot of money and a lot of power, so if it doesn't stick the first time, we'll try it again, and we'll tweak it a little bit, and we'll try it again, and we'll try it again in Texas, and we'll try it again in other places. And so, you know, I think the reality when you look at places like Texas and you hear these conversations on the phone is it's almost, you know, I mean, the reality is really almost incomprehensible.
If the decision would not come down on the side of restricting the restrictions, is that a good way to put
it? Right, yep.
Then basically this now has the opportunity to roll over into other circuits, into other states, to try out and see if their legislatures would pass similar bills that could possibly do the same thing in more states.
Right. So the law itself wouldn't then, so the law itself would be specific to Texas. So that in its own right wouldn't go to other things in the circuit. But the knowledge that this was held as, you know, upheld as constitutional or even referred back to the circuit court, then emboldens other states to say, all right, well, we're going to continue, you know, we're going to do the same.
Right.
And that, again, it continues, it continues to chip away at the right. And when you hear again, when you hear the callers and you hear Amy Hagstrom Miller talk about the fact that increasingly you have people say, you know, I could do a 2-day visit, I can't pull off the third. I could actually probably get, you know, childcare coverage, and I could probably call out of work that day. I can't do that three times. And so, you know, the story of the 13-year-old is incredibly compelling and brutal. The thought of, you know, she talks, we've burdened her to parenthood, and then you think she's a 13-year-old rape victim. I mean, parenthood, this isn't an active decision. But then, so that case, and then also certainly just those realities of all of those women who we didn't hear their individual stories, but who the inability to say make it to that doctor's appointment three times over then says, okay, and I'm going to be a mother again. And the vast majority of women who are having abortions are mothers, and, you know, as Amy spoke to. So these are women who know the realities of what that is, which is exactly the reason that they're choosing to have a termination. It's because they know, for those that are mothers, what it takes to be a mother, what they want it to look like. And certainly for those who aren't and know that they don't want to be at that particular time.
Yeah.
So I want to feel hopeful, and certainly being here in this space surrounded by all of you feels hopeful, because it's allies, it's partners, it's providers, it's, you know, from reproductive justice allies and legal allies, and it's all of those pieces. And so this space feels very hopeful. Seeing the film, you know, and I think it's reading the transcript of the Supreme Court, I mean, I think you can certainly find places of hope and see the outcome, and hear, you know, the brilliant voices of the justices who took patient stories and took, you know, what many of us sort of sent, however it was. And, you know, you can also see the other piece. So I sit here and hold all of us up to see that bright outcome.
I want to chime in there a little bit and just also uplift the women whom we don't hear from in this film, those folks who, you know, most likely would not make it back a second and third and fourth time for a number of reasons, but those women who never made it in the door the first time, right, because of the different intersectional barriers that they're experiencing, that where they live, and alongside the intersectional forms of reproductive oppression that they're facing, perhaps in their own communities, but perhaps in spaces where they are, you know, going to access services that may not be uplifting the fullness of their experiences, and how hard it is for them to get there, perhaps, and to stay in that kind of a care. I had the opportunity to hear Dr. Parker speak over the weekend at the Civil Liberties and Public Policy Forum, and I was, you know, I was talking to Curtis before about how chilling it was to hear him address a room full of advocates and organizers about how certain he was that he has a purpose and that he will continue to do this work until they lock him away. And he literally put his arms out like this and say, "I would rather lose my freedom and lose my ability to practice this kind of medicine than to be incarcerated, than to live in a society where folks do not have the right to make decisions about their own body." And I'll add in that, you know, the right to make decisions about their wellness as related to their gender, their sexuality, their work, their labor, and their reproduction, and all that means. And I think reproductive justice becomes a framework where we can begin to talk about what all of those things are, and what parenting looks like, depending on how those parts of our identities play out, and how we can foster sustainable support for folks who may not fit into some of the mainstream narratives that are presented.
Let's stay there for a second, if you don't mind, Lexi, because one of the other things that struck me in the film is that we have elected officials who seem to have a very different knowledge of our founding documents and the evolution of our political process than I do. And you know, it always strikes me that I didn't think I liked history. at a certain point in my secondary schooling until I got to high school. And then all of a sudden I had a U.S. history teacher who made it very real for me. And as an adult, now I'm fascinated with the way that we as a humanity evolve or devolve, depending on your perspective. And so this idea of the balance of powers of our U.S. government, executive, judicial, and legislative, and how they're supposed to work as a checks and balance for defining what the actual rules are that we as citizens are supposed to live by. And here in 2016, we have states like North Carolina and Mississippi who have passed bills under the idea of religious liberty that are extremely discriminatory, and that there are people who are trying to, in some way in their rhetoric, tell us that they're trying to get back to the original intent of our founding documents, where I know personally, I wasn't considered a whole person in the original founding documents, and that's why we have amendments that update it to accommodate the will of the people, one, but also an evolving idea of what we're supposed to be as a democracy. So in thinking about marginalized communities that your advocacy represents and where that fits into the picture of how these laws are being implemented in some states, where is the opportunity, I guess, for more intersectionality in advocating for the poor, in advocating for the queer community, in advocating for people of color, specifically to have a voice in how these laws evolve?
Thank you for that question. I think the opportunity has to be across various spaces. And I think for me, I can speak personally to really believing in the power of education and the power of having literacy around these issues. I've seen in my own work that the language of reproductive justice can be very here, right? How do we make that language applicable in communities that need that language and who often don't have the platform to voice their experiences? There's a privilege analysis to be had around who even can sit up here, right, and speak out about some of these issues. And so I want to be very intentional about naming that and talking about, you know, the ways that we can, you know, on the day-to-day practice, in our practice, and I'm not a service provider, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the providers here in the city of Philadelphia and beyond who are doing this work. But really, I think driving home conversations, you know, with communities around what it is that they need to help navigate their experiences in healthcare settings. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, once they leave those spaces, I want to also speak a little bit to your point on this sort of organized radical right, radical religious right that we're seeing, and the effects of that sort of, you know, the rhetoric of religious freedom, you know, driving wedges in communities and in, you know, marginalized communities that utilize, you know, oftentimes spirituality and religion as a vehicle for uplifting, for creating hope in their communities, and how really negative it can be when that rhetoric, you know, becomes sort of pervasive across marginalized communities, and how that can create tensions, you know, even within our quote-unquote, you know, safe spaces. So right. I wanted to just speak to that. Mm-hmm.
This is going to be it, and then I would love for you all to be able to ask questions as well. It's an election year, as we all know, and one of the things that I feel sometimes gets lost in the conversation that I think is made very poignantly in this film is that it's not just about our presidential candidates, that there's a whole system of legislature that has a huge impact on how rules are applied in our society on a state level and on a local level as well. And so here in Pennsylvania, we have an opportunity to not only look at those people who are running for presidential candidates, the entire Pennsylvania House of Representatives is up for re-election. We have our part of our Congress people are also competing for votes again. And are there concerns that you all have in terms of looking at what the scope is for things that we're considering right here at home that we as a voting public need to be considering as it relates to reproductive rights, reproductive justice, and also maybe a leaning in terms of our state legislature around issues of medical rights and access?
So I will first speak a little bit to the work and vision of New Voices, and we're based in Pennsylvania and in Ohio, but really trying to engage young folks of color, queer and trans and gender nonconforming folks of color, in political engagement and integrated voter engagement work, but also in leadership development programs and initiatives that are encouraging folks to become leaders and to feel empowered, you know, when the time is right to run for office. And a number of the advocates who are in the room today are doing really powerful work statewide and beyond, but I'll speak to Pennsylvania around the Pennsylvania Agenda and Campaign for Women's Health, and push, you know, coming together to push through various pieces of legislation as they affect the different communities that we represent. So I do believe that we have a strong foundation with regards to this sort of sector of work. You know, the scary part is, you know, when we have elected officials who are very adamantly against the work that we do, what is our plan then? And also, how do we come together and make our work national? You know, how do we organize and get to the Supreme Court, you know, on opening arguments of House Bill 2, right. which we did, you know, we did. We were able, and I think that we're at a moment in time right now where we're seeing how pervasive the negative effects of this kind of legislation can be and how quickly it can happen. And I think that it's going to be important for us to maintain our coalition building initiatives and our ability to find common ground and to work together.
So it sounds like there's a movement happening to engage young people and the communities that you've named in an ongoing effort to be engaged.
Yes.
Beyond this election year.
Yes.
Yeah. And for you, Kurt.
No, and I think, you know, to Lexi's point, I mean, I think I pulled this up, and I know the table's outside in terms of sort of what can we do. And I think the piece about voting is obviously so primary, and it is one of the most basic things. And I think, you know, looking at the Campaign for Women's Health as a place that really is an umbrella over so many of these issues about equal pay and parental leave and breastfeeding and, you know, all of these different pieces of things that are obviously incredibly important, and speak again to the health affirmation, those pieces of things that say this is about health promotion. I think one of the things that we can do is, again, is look at the Campaign for Women's Health and things like that as places that we can identify also. You know, you sort of identify the thing that moves you, and what's the thing that really, like, gets you? I mean, there's so many things that we could all just, you know, sign up for and rally for and march for and all of that, and what's the thing that truly moves you? And looking at that thing and doing it incredibly well and looking at the intersection as to where those things are. So I think, to Lexi's point, that we don't live single-issue lives. We don't. None of us. And so where are the places that all of these come together, and what's the place that the places that really move you in that? And I think, you know, as an abortion provider, and not as a single issue, but that is certainly one of my most primary, making sure that we say abortion really loudly over and over and over again in spaces that actually aren't set up for it and don't want to hear it. And knowing, like, what does that mean in terms of allies who've worked really hard in the Capitol to move something forward, and saying abortion really loudly what is that going to do? You know, what does that set back if you've gotten this legislator to say yes on this, but then you're also asking them to consider this? And those are really complicated conversations that we have to have. And so I think we continue to have them, and we have them in ways that ultimately, essentially, we are moving those things forward, and everyone stays true to the thing that feels most true to them, while also not taking out any of our allies in the process.